Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
Welcome back to The Bulwark Goes to Hollywood. My name is Sonny Bunch. I'm culture editor at The Bulwark, and I'm very pleased to be joined today by Jake Van Kersen. Now, if you're a reader of The Bulwark, if you're in the comments of The Bulwark, you will sometimes perhaps see comments from Jake VK. He's all over the place. I mentioned this. We were going to be doing this show on our call this week, and Tim Miller, the one and only Tim Miller, was like, oh yeah, Jake VK, he's great. That's a lesson to everybody out there. If you make something and you're nice to us, you might get on my podcast. But Jake, thank you for being on the show today.
Thank you for having me on here, and thank you to everyone at The Bulwark for that nice little welcome, mostly to Tim, I guess I'm talking about. I guess this mostly is like, yeah, mostly to Tim. Thank you, Tim. Sonny, I hope you don't mind having this as a consolation prize for not having Ben Stiller.
You know, I'm not going to say that's how it came up in the meeting, but we'll leave it at that. So what we are here to discuss today is the movie you directed with mm-hmm. some friends, businessmen, colleagues, whatever. It's called I Agree With You. Just showed it at Chicago's Music Box Theater. But what I want this show to be is a kind of how to make an independent movie and how to get it seen by people episode. Basically, a sort of explainer. I want to walk through step by step what you guys have done to get this made and in front of people. All right. So that, just to set everybody's expectations out there, that's what we're going to be doing today. So Jake, you are the director. How did this project get started? How did it get conceived? Where did this come from?
Yeah, so there's a couple different tracks for how this journey started. One is way back. I went to film school here in Chicago, Chicago's Columbia College, Chicago, actually. And when you graduate from film school, there's not like a movie making factory that you go to with your resume and say like, hey, I have this, I graduated, can I make a movie? Instead, you kind of have to go, find your own path or go to LA or any number of like different routes, but there's not like that direct route. Like if you're a teacher and you get a teaching certificate, you guys get it. So I have, since graduating college, spent a lot of time either doing digital media because of the, YouTube has made video more available, or working for small production houses, doing web series, doing independent web series, doing music videos, all kinds of odd jobs, a couple weddings, which is, I feel like, a rite of passage if you finish film school as a way to quickly make some money.
You mean like as a videographer, taping,
videographer,
filming people's weddings?
Yes, exactly. Filming people's weddings is like sort of something you can do. But what I'm saying is like you don't just get to go join and make a movie. So I have been fortunate and have been able to pay my bills making videos and freelancing and whatnot. But I could never get rid of that desire to actually make a feature film. Made short films, all sorts of things. But, there's something about a feature. And to that brings me to the next track, which is, and this is like just a personal thing, is that I have a couple of kids and they're starting to figure out what they might want to do when they grow up. And I always thought like they know that I went to film school and if I never made a movie, it would be a little hard for me to say, well, go do whatever you want. And they said, well, you never made a movie and you went to film school, in which case I'd be like, okay, so I do need to be serious about at least doing a feature film. This all comes up against some practical things, which is our writer slash one of the leads of this film, Ross Compton, had just put up a play that took place in one location, and it was very good, and I liked it a lot, and this was around 2019, and so I said, hey, Ross, let's make a movie. Like, why don't you just go ahead and write something like this as a movie? And he happened to be kicking around an idea. And then we have two other producers, Scott Cupper and Tyler Core, and they wanted to do, you know, actually, like, make do this as well. So from there, Ross wrote a script, and then we did a table read in the last week of December just to get a feel of that draft. And then we were hoping to do it in 2020, and that road was blocked for us.
What happened in 2020, Jake? In 2020? I can't remember.
We just got so busy playing video games and spending a lot of time with our family and streaming a lot.
Sure.
I can't remember other details, but it took up a lot of time. And so, which turned into many rewrites of the script. So, you know, like we tried to find some ways to make lemonade from it. So we did that. And that's like sort of the origin of it. And then, so around 2021, I am at my kid's school open house, and I run into a film professor that I had at Columbia named John Otterbacher. And when I was at school, he was in his mid-20s, and he was cool because he actually was producing independent feature films. He had shown us a couple of clips, and I said, hey, John, I want to do this. And so I want to, can we get coffee and can we just chat about everything I need to do? And he said, absolutely. And in that time, he had kind of become this, like, I've kept running into him throughout Chicago from the time I graduated to this day, because he had been doing independent features and all kinds of short films, and been on boards around town of, like, filmmaking groups and everything. So he was just a wealth of knowledge, and I sat down with him, and that's where we kind of get into the practical side of making a independent feature film, which is there's a lot of paperwork that one should do in order to start off on the right foot.
Okay, so paperwork. You got to do some paperwork. What you're saying here, you have to do, there's paperwork you have to do to get it off the ground properly. What does that entail?
So, yeah. Now, if you're listening and you have a script that you're ready to do and an iPhone ready to go, yeah, you can go shoot your film and nothing should stop you. But if you are going to look for financing, if you're going to look for, you know, hiring a crew, you should do some basic steps that are not like the glamour side of filmmaking, but like start a film production company and an LLC, a limited liability company. Now, the reason for the LLC is that if your money turns a profit, you're going to want to make sure all that money is going just to that film. Right. So like that, if you make other films, this is pretty standard for filmmaking. Like if you watch credits at the end, you'll see, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. LLCs, because it makes sure that everything is housed into the title of that was produced. But also you're going to want insurance for your gear, for your sets, even this film, which is just one location. If our cinematographer is caught up in the moment and he has the camera up on his shoulder and he puts his heel through drywall, like, or worse, like, you know, we're going to want to have the production covered. If a camera gets dropped down the stairs, you're going to have that covered. So having an LLC means that you can then insure the production through that, those means. Also, we found that after we had become like a started an LLC and we were registered here with the state of Illinois, we were able to just put a better foot forward when we started to talk to organizations or people that we might want to hire, because it does speak to sort of like, oh, you have your stuff together, right? You're not showing up to an interview with like sweatpants and a hoodie and Crocs. You're like, you put on, you know, a suit because you really want to engage with people. That also helped us make sure that we were able to, or not make sure, but because we had the LLC, then we were able to open up a bank account, right? So then all the money is going into that account instead of one of our checking accounts where we then have to like create two different spreadsheets and make sure that the grocery money is not going from the catering budget. So these are like very practical in steps that take a little bit of time. But if you are going and you want to, again, like I said, get financing or talk to outside groups, it's just like that sort of work that makes it, that separates you from the pack of that person with a good script and an iPhone.
So you mentioned raising money. I mean, and this was not an expensive film. I think you said in the emails it was a $20,000 movie. Is that that's about right. So I mean, raising money. When I think of stories of people raising money, it's like Sam Raimi, you know, as a 20-year-old who needs to raise like a not small amount of money to make The Evil Dead. It was a $250,000 or something like that in, you know, 1979 dollars. So like that's not a small amount of money. But you know, I like $20,000 also not a small amount of money, but also in theory, you know, like if you've got four or five guys there together, you could have maybe paid for it yourself, but like also that creates a lot of personal financial risk exposure, et cetera. So when you, where did you go to raise the money for this?
So taking a step back, the script is written in one location with two people. So rather than writing a big, like, script or even like a script that needed a location change, we kind of were writing it so that if we only had $5,000, we could feasibly make it. But $20,000 is a good amount of money, and I'm very like grateful for everyone that contributed and to it, but it also goes very quickly. And so that's sort of the thing, is like when we were dreaming about what this first feature could be, it was, you know, how can we do it for a good amount of money and make sure that every cent is spent well, and that even though it is a very small movie, that you can see it on the screen. So we set that, you know, those guidelines, and then we said we would really like to raise at least $20,000 to do it. Which brings us to, we went to a platform called Seed and Spark for crowdfunding. Crowdfunding is not fun, but it is like, you know, something that a lot of independent filmmakers end up doing. And it's not fun because you're going to your network of friends and family and associates and you're saying, like, you basically just have to like fundraise, and it's a lot of work. But Seed and Spark was a great partner for it. And the reason why we went with Seed and Spark over some of the ones that you might know, like Kickstarter or Indiegogo or anything like that, is because Seed and Spark said that they have this like process. You can't just put up your campaign and have a green light and start, you know, raising money. They claim, and in my experience, it's true, to have a process that guarantees that more films are, or more campaigns are, reach their goals. Guarantee for legal purposes is my word, not theirs. I don't know if it was on there, but it's, they say that it helps. And so I submitted maybe three or four times our campaign details, and they got back to me and they said, you should change this. You should rethink this. This is where we find that people succeed. This is like might be
what sort of things were they having you change?
Just like what perks we offered people, like the descriptions of, you know, like the movie itself, being very specific about how we were hoping to spend the money. So these were all like sort of like ideas that I had written down that then I had to like firm up and think about. Like, if you raise X amount of dollars, where will that go? Well, it's going to go to the camera department. It's going to go to the sound department. You know, on the perk side, it was like, are you over-promising? We find that most people have a better success rate if instead of like, we're going to send you a t-shirt, for instance, like we're going to send you, like do a social media shout out, like things that would help you also like, you know, help promote the campaign and on your social media platforms and everything like that. So very like things that frankly were not in my purview, but they had done so many that they were able, like, you know, if you do this, I think this is going to work out a little bit better for you. And it's also like there's a couple of platforms too that will be like, no matter how much you get, you will, you know, get the money minus like whatever fees that they take. This one is not like that. We had to reach at least 80% to be able to be fully funded, and then everything else after that is good. And for me personally, I would say that that was a great like mentality thing, because you go, oh, if we get some money, we'll be good. But it was like, no, guys, we have to work. We have to like kick over every stone. So from there, we got about $5,000. So roughly a quarter of our eventual production budget. So then came the next step. And I had a few people that knew that I was going to go about this journey of making a feature film. And they were friends and family that were like, oh, if I can support you, I will. Which was incredibly gracious of them. But I was like, man, I don't want to just like sort of take that and not find a way to, you know, reward them, maybe is too strong of a word, but along that way, like show my appreciation in some tangible way, because, you know, there's the examples of the micro budget indies that go, you know, big, like Clerks or Blair Witch or, you know, something like that. But in reality, a lot of us are out there doing it and not going to have that level of success. So I went to John Otterbacher, who I mentioned earlier, who had since became like our executive producer. Like it was something that we said, can we make you executive producer? Because you're doing so much guidance with us anyway, that we want to, like, you know, again, give you a title, or you've earned it. But you know what I mean. So he said, I said, John, how does it work when you get into like sort of investing? And he was basically like, don't say those words in a sentence ever again. Investing and filmmaking. Because as soon as you start down that path, and at, you know, the SEC regulates investments, and there are different categorizations of investors, and there's just a whole bunch of issues that could come up with that.
Well, that's an interesting digression, just because I remember a few years back, I can't remember exactly when this was, but the Broken Lizard guys were talking about how they basically wanted to turn the funding of Super Troopers 2 into an investment opportunity. Like, you give us $1,000, we give you a share of the movie, and you get some, you know, XYZ percentage points. And they couldn't quite do it with that one. I think eventually there was some sort of platform. But that's because, again, it falls under, like, once you start talking investments, you get into, like, real tricky regulatory ground.
Yeah, and, you know, I think this joke is going to play with the Bulwark crowd, but, like, at the time, the SEC was a thing. And I think it still is, at least for our level of people. Unless I'm minting a crypto coin, in which case, maybe, you know, next time.
You never know.
I made that joke at the music box and it took a second. And then I was like, oh, crap. I hope that everyone knows that I'm joking. And the SEC, for all intents and purposes, is still very much a real thing, yeah. Especially for people like us. So people like, you know, mid-level people or lower. So how do we solve this situation? Well, John said that, told me, there is a thing called a fiscal sponsor. And what that is essentially is that a non-for-profit, filmmaking non-for-profit can take on your project under their fiscal sponsorship, like sort of a banner. And then when people contribute to your film, they are contributing via the fiscal sponsor. So this is like a multi-beneficial thing where, you know, a non-for-profit gets a bit of a donation. The donation is made to them and they exist to help filmmakers, right? So mm-hmm. This is all like they're in their mission statement and whatnot. But they get, you know, I think in our case, it was like 5%-ish, somewhere around there. And then that money goes to you. Mm-hmm. But for the people that are helping contribute through this way, they are able to then get a tax write-off when they sit mm-hmm. down to do their taxes.
Yeah, yeah.
So, you know, they are able to, like, so, like, you know, I don't take this as, like, actual numbers, but, like, a $7,000 investment then could actually only cost them on paper like $5,000, $4,000, something like that. So it is beneficial yeah. to them. And especially like, I don't want to generalize too much, but if somebody is able to do this, chances are that they're kind of deduction hunting anyway at the end of yeah. the year. And so this, it all adds up. So this was a way that we could show gratitude and be like sort of serious about these people that are then became also executive producers in name because they were actually financing doing quite a bit of financing for us.
Does that change what you can do with the film if you're taking money as a or from a nonprofit as a grant? Does that change? So let's say you let's say just again using random numbers here. Let's say you took $10,000 from a nonprofit to mm-hmm. fund the filming mm-hmm. of the movie. And then you sold this movie to A24 for $1 million, you know, big Sundance hit. Yeah. You sell it for $1 million. What does that actually, do you have to pay that back? Like, or does it, what's the actual, or it's just like money and now it's yours and whatever happens, happens.
Yeah. In fact, you know, I'll come back if I am, you know, if I have to deal with this situation, I'll come back and tell you how we dealt with it. Well, and happily. But I know it's all pretty much on the board. But to your point, what our fiscal sponsor was the Independent Film Alliance of Chicago. And we looked around at a couple other ones and they all do have very specific things of what they're looking for in guidelines for if you like, I had to sign paperwork, you know, about like, if we, like, go with you, we will do these things. And one of them was, just make sure, like, if you watch the film, you will see at the very end, they get their own credit. That was part of the guidelines that we did it. We also had to adhere to some, like, principles that they are promoting for, you know, like Chicago filmmaking, like just mm-hmm. basic, you know, like we really want you to do, you know, like make sure you treat people this way. Like basically, so we were under sort of their, you know, like guidelines and whatnot. But and there are other like non-for-profits that might prioritize like female filmmakers. And in order to be brought onto their, you would have to like be a female filmmaker and whatnot. So you are like, when you do that, you will want to like search for ones that like match up with who you are and what you're trying to do. Like if you're trying to do this kind of story, you know, there could be that. So like if you're, you know, if you're telling a story about this people group or this topic, there's probably, there might be a not-for-profit with a fiscal sponsorship opportunity that would match up with you. So with these, we had to be in Chicago. We had to, you know, like sort of work with all that. And it was great. It was a good matchup. And they're really a great organization as well.
Yeah. Okay. So, you've raised the money. You've got $20,000 in your bank account. What is the next step? Is it, did you already have your, so Ross, wrote and starred in, did you have your other, actor, ready and locked in, or was that a casting process? How did you guys get, Stevie Shale, to be Ross's, girlfriend, live-in girlfriend?
So Stevie and Ross and, again, our producer Tyler Core all went to Ball State together in Indiana. And Stevie is an actress, and Ross was, and I believe they were both in the theater program. So she had lived in Chicago at that point, and she'd been doing a lot of comedy, and she's just great. And so she was at that first table read. She was the one that we sort of tapped and said, hey, we want to hear how this script sounds being performed. Can you come and do that? And so she was pretty much Penny from the jump, the character that she plays. Now, to your point, is which saved us, you know, like A, she's talented, B, she was right for the part, and C, a lovely person. So it was just like, great, we don't have to go through the audition process, which is something I had to do before, and I don't like it at all. Like it's a series of first dates where like it's just not for me. So that was good. But after we have the money, then you start having in our case a series of decisions to make with that money. And one of them is like, Stevie had since moved to LA, so we still wanted her in the film, and we wanted to compensate her. So part of the budget went to that because she's a working actress, which Ross is a producer, and I'm a director, and Ross is also the screenwriter, and we were like, hey, we are going to not, you know, get paid from this because of the right, you know, it's just not in the cards. Now, it's a movie, right? So there are two things that you need for every movie, which is picture and sound. So the next step was to find a cinematographer, and usually you'll also need to start calling rental houses or whatnot to get the gear that you need.
What did you shoot with?
It was a Panasonic GH. Oh, I can't remember, but it was a Panasonic camera.
Okay. But it's a digital film, not
yes, digital film.
Yeah.
Digital film. And we went with that because that's what the DP is. So again, I'm going to say his name a lot, but John Otterbacher, he had a bunch of gear that he got, and he worked with this DP named Sebastian Lama, who he was like, I really think you should meet Sebastian, at least consider him for your DP because he's like you. He's been doing shorts. He's been doing, you know, all sorts of different things, but he really wants to do a feature. So, like, just meet up with him and whatever you have to do, you know, you got to make the decision as the director, but at least just talk to him. So I was like, yeah, sure. 100%. And so I'm talking to Sebastian and I'm just like, this is the guy. Like it's just like a thing. It's like you click or you don't. It's chemistry or it's not. And he's a very laid back on the surface guy, but he's very thorough in his thinking. And so I'm meeting with him, and then he has a rate, right? And so that's where a big chunk of the money goes. So I'm answering that. So, but with Sebastian, because he also had this gear with John, great. Like they were like, as a package deal, but it was a sizable part of our budget. Again, makes sense, right? We're making a movie. Yeah. Then next you need sound. And sound is, we had a referral, and it was a guy named Garrett Schultz, and he did our location sound. And he, to his credit and his right, quoted us his rate. And again, a good amount of our budget went to Garrett, but worth it because he was extremely kind, extremely professional, and did a great job. And it's a thankless chore on a film set to be a location sound person. If you've seen behind the scenes movies or whatnot, it's the guy with the pole, the boom mic, like getting in there and sometimes getting yelled at for getting in the shot and whatnot.
Yeah.
So
it's heavy. It's like, heavy. It's like a workout all day. You got your arms in weird locations, you know?
Yeah. In fact, while you listen to this, put your arms up without a boom mic and see how long until you're like, oh, I can't wait to do it. And when you see the movie, we did a lot of like long takes too. So he was happy to do that. Now here comes to the point where these are not prescription, but they are suggestions. Your listeners might know what a script supervisor is. If not, script supervisors are in charge of, among other things, continuity. So making sure that, you know, because you usually don't shoot films in order. So they're making sure that the wardrobes are the same for the scene. Was there a stain on that shirt after scene 25 shot, you know, 25B? Yeah, there was. So anything after that needs a stain. Did they say the right line? Because this is not, it was very light improvisation in this, but like, did Stevie deliver the line the right way when we did that take? So when we have to do it again and match it with Ross's, you know, on him, is that going to match? All these like little invisible things that you don't notice when you watch a movie, but if they're wrong, it will take you out of the movie. So that I had met our script supervisor at a Independent Film Alliance Chicago meetup, and we were just talking, and he gave me his card, and I was like, we don't have reshoot money, so we don't have the location beyond the 5 days that we were shooting this thing. So I wanted a script supervisor, and again, we got Joe, and we got Joe's rate, so that's another chunk of the money out. And then another thing that I knew that we would need, again, because we have 5 days, and we were going to do 10-hour days with lunch, but also we started to, bank overtime at the end of the day, because we wanted people out after 12 hours. Like, there are too many independent films that will take advantage of people's time and resources and talents, and we did not want to do that. So in order to do that, you need someone to be watching the clock and making sure that you are hitting all your shots and you're doing it in your time and you're making your day. And that's what a first assistant director does. And so, again, my mentality going into this is if we don't get it in production, we can never come back to this. We don't have the money. So every cent that we can put towards production, like, is money well spent. And if we have to like beg and hit people up later or like find other solutions for post-production, we'll do that. So we hired the Jamie to be our first AD, and well spent, and she was a delight as well. But because she was there, we never paid overtime. We always, mm-hmm. In fact, we ended up finishing a little early on our last day. So because we hired Jamie, all that money was being saved, right? Because it's rolling back up into the production budget again. Then the last crew member that we hired is Sebastian, came back to me and he said, like, John Otterbacher is still a college professor here in Chicago. So I was like, I would love to give an opportunity to like some of his students that want to do this. But Sebastian was like, I work with an assistant camera person named Anna, and we have like, we don't even need to speak. We're just in sync with each other. And I know that I'm about to ask you to spend more money than you were planning to do, but it will be crucial for me on set to not have to get to know a whole new camera department. And an assistant camera person does stuff like pulse focus, you know, mm-hmm. like just among many other things. I don't want to shortchange it, but like you want your movie in focus, right? So,
yeah.
So we sprang, and again, worth it. We got lucky on the location. We knew somebody that had a sort of rental property that was not going to be used. So that was money, too, that we were able to save. But
mm-hmm.
the long and the short of it is that those are the very practical things we did with it. But what happens is, like, there's always shifting and there's always, like, reallocating and trying to make it work on this budget, right? Because we have the set amount. And could we have used a couple more crew people? Maybe. Yeah, probably. There were unexpected expenses that would come up. You know, and we would have to do that. And then also...
Like what? What was an unexpected expense?
We tried to do... We went to independent film and we're like, oh, we'll just buy lunch ingredients and everyone can like make it on the set. And which doesn't sound unreasonable. But after the first day, a crew member who was experienced like said, hey, I get what you're doing here. But we're on our feet and we need to eat like construction workers. We need protein. We need like heavy food to get through the day so we have the energy. So that meant like we had all this food and we're like, well, we'll try to use it. But every day that we were taking food orders, a very small expense. But again, that's like – or small seeming expense or small thing probably. But like you're talking about $100, $200 a day that's being yeah. added up. Again, so you can get it all on screen.
I'm trying to think. So you have what, like 7-8 people on set?
Two, four of us, Stevie. Yeah, about 8. Yeah.
Yeah. So eight lunches a day times 5 days. You know, that's
yeah,
that's $1,000.
It was
$700. You know, $700 somewhere in there. Yeah. No,
and everyone, not us, the producers are getting paid too. But like, there are sets that I've been on where they're like, oh, we'll just pay you in food. And it's just another thing. It's well-meaning, but like at the same time, these are professionals, yeah. you know. So they needed to get paid and treated with respect and get like yeah. the things that they're supposed to do. Because we also want to make sure on the next one, people are like, oh, they treat people well. We wanted to treat people well, you know, long-term as well. Like,
sure.
No one's going to do any good by being... short shifting their crew is just not mm-hmm. going to work out for you in the short or long term.
Yeah. All right. So you shoot the movie. Mm-hmm. You get all this together. You shoot the movie. I mean, look, there's a million stories, I'm sure, every day. But what would be one piece of advice as a director of a $20,000 feature that you would give somebody, aside from having, you know, having your first assistant director there, having the script supervisor, et cetera, et cetera. If you are crunched for time, you're crunched you've only got the one location, you've only mm-hmm. got these people here. What do you recommend folks focus on when they're trying to get stuff done in that short order as director?
You have to prepare as much as you can in pre-production. Because when you're on production, in production, on set, things are just going to happen. Neighbors upstairs, like we were shooting on location, right? So we were at this place. So people are walking upstairs or doing something. And after a while, you're like, oh, do we send someone up to ask them to be quiet or not? So... or just kind of wait for them to go on. But like everything is, you're on the clock from the minute people show up. Like you, and get there early and pre-plan everything. Now, part of the reason why you want to pre-plan everything, excuse me, is I spent 2 days shot listing the whole movie. I don't do storyboards, but I was like shot listing. And when Sebastian came into town to do this, I said, hey, I have these, like, I did this shot list. And he goes, yeah. And honestly, I was falling. I was like, oh my gosh, we have 5 days to shoot this thing. I'm just gonna do it safe. I'm gonna do establishing shot, close up for everything, for most things, you know, to just to make sure that we make it. And Sebastian looks at it and he goes, we could do that, but this is such a small movie in one location. I think we should tie ourselves to the mast, sort of, so to speak, and like do, you know, just wide shots without any cutaways, or when you see the movie, like just sort of like let the story and the characters speak more. And I guess I should be like, no, I'm the director. This is an auteur thing, but that's not how I am at all. Like film is collaborative. Like the director, you know, the director has to make the calls. So, but he came up with a better idea. So I was like, okay, threw away 2 days worth of work. And in 2 hours, we replanned the whole movie. But to your question is, that's sort of like a illustration of like, you need to plan everything if you're directing a short film, if you're a micro budget film, short film, big film, plan everything. Take the time to do it because you are going to be hit with good things like a DP that is like shot listed the whole movie like with you in a couple hours because he had a different sort of ethos for how to shoot it, or you know, something on set like physically breaks, or the power goes out, or someone's running late, or someone gets sick. We were spared from any of these things, but they could all happen, right? And also on the third or fourth day, Stevie as Penny has a big emotional moment. And it's like maybe 4 minutes of the movie, but the whole day leading up to when we shot that, she was totally different. And I was like, what happened after she left set last night? Did she get some bad news? Did something happen? And so at one point I pulled her aside and I was like, everything's cool, right? And she's like, oh yeah, I'm great. And I was like, oh, she was getting in her head all day, not method, preparation on her part as an actress to play this scene. And I'm biased, I directed it, but I see it all when she did it. It's a scene where you've seen it, but they're on the bed and they finally have mm-hmm. the camera moment where they're like, you know, right in eyes on you. So, but she was prepping all day. But what am I saying? I'm saying like, I still, even though the whole set was like, cause she's a very bright person who gets along. Everybody was with her in that because of the size of our movie. But as a director, so they were all bummed out. And part of it, I was like, once we got it, I was like, we got that, we're moving on. And
everybody happy again.
Yeah, the whole mood lifted. But as a director, you have to, like, when you're running a set, like, again, you have to know what's going on. And I just said that I did totally know her whole process there. But I still couldn't stop doing what I was doing. Like, I still had to keep everyone moving. I had to make sure everything was okay. And then also, I have to, like, make sure that we're keeping the emotional crux of the film going and keeping all that. So prepare is it. And I could give you a thousand stories about like how important a preparation is. But that's the bottom line is, so that whatever you're doing, make sure you know what you're going to do. Cause I don't even remember those 5 days. I remember independent, like in little moments, but I have no idea really what happened. I woke up here in my home. I went to set. I came home, and somewhere in there, I made a movie.
Yeah, yeah. All right. So movie shot, movie done. Mm-hmm. In the can. Did you guys hire an editor, or did you edit?
I was prepared to edit, but Daniel Scoobel, who I knew from one of my previous jobs 15 years ago, again, we just clicked. He was like, he knew that I was, I had talked to him and he works for a production company and we had been like, would it work if we just hired you guys to be on set with us? And unfortunately, unfortunately for me, but fortunately they were very honest about their rate and I was very honest about our budget. And they just did not match this time. But I still, those guys are great. But Daniel was, or Dan, professionally named Daniel Scooble, but I call him Dan. He was like, I still want to edit this thing for you. And I said, are you sure? And he said, yes. And I, and so he did it. Now, I don't know how much experience you have, Sonny, with independent films, but or even short films, they can languish sometimes for very good reasons. I'm not looking down on anyone in post-production for years. Mm-hmm. Because if you, and so I, Garrett, when we wrapped, we all went out to dinner. It was really fun. And then I took a drive and I gave it to Garrett, the location scout guy. And he was like, I'm going to bring it to Dan. The next day he brings it to Dan and Dan calls me and he says, is there anything I need to know? And I was basically like, you know, again, not an auteur director. I said, I was like, we've talked about this movie. You've read the script. You have the footage. In editing, it's its own art form.
Mm-hmm.
I was like, call me when it's done and I'll sit down with you and we'll like figure out what goes on from there. What I'm saying is like, I wanted Dan to let the movie dictate what he saw in the footage and what he saw from the script to inform his edit more than me over his shoulder being sure. Like, no, not that take. I mean, sure. I had notes again, script supervisor. I was like, I like that take, make that note, use that one, things like that. But so I give it to Dan in like August, 2023 in like mid September, he calls me and he's like, it's ready. And I was like, after a month, and he's like, yeah, do you want to come see it? And that's where I panicked, because all of a sudden it was like this like back burner thing. And it was like, I'm going to see the assembly cut of this thing. And whatever dreams I have about how it turns out is going to meet reality. And I don't know what reality is going to be. But somewhere along
the way. How long was the assembly cut?
Maybe 10 more minutes.
Yeah.
I would safely say. There's a funny aside. Let me finish this and I'll come back to it. But Sofia Coppola one time said her dad told her that your movie is never as good as your dailies make you think it will be. Dailies are what you shot in that day, like that, those independent, you know, footage or that those independent like scenes.
Mm-hmm.
And never as bad as your assembly cut is going to be. And so every time I was going about like driving my kids to school, doing, you know, working, whatever, and I start to panic, I just repeated that like a mantra. And as I drove to go watch it, I just said it over and over to myself again. So, and when I looked at it, I was like, I think from there, I was like, oh, no, everything's here. It's just a matter of fine tuning now, which it is, because there's that adage of, you know, a film is written, quote unquote, three times, the script,
right.
On set and editing. And I now having experienced it, there were different iterations of the movie, evolving iterations every step of the way, including the edit where we started to put together like the montage towards the end changed probably the most as we like fine tuned how we wanted that to work.
Mm-hmm.
You had a question though. You asked me how long the edit was.
Yeah, that was just how long the assembly cut was. Because I'm always curious how much gets trimmed down. Because I mean, you know, this is not a long movie. I think it's 75 minutes in final cut. And I assume you probably weren't doing tons of takes that you weren't using, just because of time. And you know, I assume that helps with the editing process, having less material to sift through.
Yeah, you know, funny enough, I'm not a multiple takes guy either, just because you usually get it or one or two. And then in my experience, and then afterwards, you're just sort of like on the edges. It works for other people. Again, if you're someone that wants to do multiple takes and everyone's agreed, do it. But for me, it's like, okay, we got it. Now we need to move on. So it was less of our time, although I was conscious about that. But the scene where we did the most takes was Penny, played by Stevie's, big moment. And because she kept asking for it, And that was like where I had to be like, because she didn't think that she got it. And I was like, no, you got it. It's like people are really gutted right now and on set. And she's like, no, no, I think I could do it again. And again, you just trust your collaborators, like actors are collaborators. The thing I was going to tell you was, at one point, our script supervisor told one of the producers as I was like walking, I was walking on set from one part to the other. And again, this is like 10 yards, but still, producer came up to me and was like, Joe says that if we keep shooting on this pace, our movie's going to be about 55 minutes long. And I was like, there's nothing I can do about it. I can't write more script pages right now. I'm not, you know, like, I don't, I was like, there's nothing I can do. So all I could do was like pull out my phone and go, Academy Award, the Academy requirements for a feature film. And those are 40 minutes. And I was like, great. I have a feature film with 15 minutes to spare. But I also knew that like some of the scenes were going to be longer and whatnot. And so we would get closer to 90. But when we're editing too, like it's asking a lot from the audience to be in one location with two people the whole time. And so I was really focused on pacing and like sort of earning every second of on screen with the audience. And last March, I did like a heat check screening where I invited like my wife and some other people to just watch the movie in a not theater setting, but just to see if it was working. And they knew us, so they laughed at all the right places. And you're like, well, is it polite? Well, if you're, you know, putting yourself out there like this, you're like, are they being polite or are they really laughing? But at one point, I was watching it and I heard two people sniffle and I looked over and those sniffles were the beginning of crying. And so two people were crying while we were doing this, like what I called the heat check screening. And I was like, oh, well, people don't polite cry. So this is actually working. They're crying at the right spot. And they weren't crying because they felt bad for us. Like, oh my gosh, this movie's so terrible. It was like, no, they were crying at the emotional downbeat of the film. And you're like, okay, we're on it. But then, you know, the first question is like, how did it feel in length? And they're like, felt great. Felt great once you got started. So that was, you know, that's kind of the thing. So 76 minutes, it feels right for this movie.
Yeah. And I do think there is a nice, I feel like that's a good time for this. I would not describe this as a mumblecore movie, but it is in that kind of same, you know, genre, very small budget, very, very tight locations, very small cast. I mean, it is in that kind of tradition. And I think between 70 and 80 minutes on something like this is about spot on.
So I'm not saying that, apology that I interrupted you there. But I'm not saying that I agree with you is like this movie I'm about to mention, but you said the word mumblecore and I had to be like, okay, which is totally fine. And if anyone doesn't know, mumblecore is a genre of independent film where people chat a lot. Probably the most like mainstream version is the Before trilogy, that Richard Linklater did. And so people, when I told them this movie that they were doing, they're like, oh, so like Before Sunrise. And I was like, no, nothing against, I love those movies, but no, because it would be too easy to do my first feature film that I directed as a mumblecore movie with this budget. So the movie that I referenced a lot was Kramer versus Kramer personally. And again, I'm not saying that we're up to that quality or anything like that, but I'm saying like that was my guiding post because that is a movie about relationships and from a time in the 70s when a movie just about relationships could win Best Picture. And so I started to lean into that. And then that was like what I looked for is like, okay, this is how I want to tell the movie and this is how I want to feel. And then Sebastian and I talked and we kind of want to stage it a little bit like a 70s movie when this was a thing and he did the coloring too. He again rose his hand and said, I want to color this thing as the DP. And I was like, oh, please do it. That makes total sense to me. So the references I gave him were a lot of like Kramer versus Kramer for the color and whatnot that I want to sort of like emulate, to be honest. Mm-hmm. And then The Holdovers had come over, came out, which a film that also harkens back to the look of films from the 70s. And so we were able to reference that a little bit too. Like, if you look at the light, it's like that very blue color. The mm-hmm. scene where they sit, or they're sitting at the table with the overhead light, we reference The Godfather lighting in Don Corleone's office at the beginning with the very orange lights and the dark. So anyway, which coloring is something that you're going to need to do too on a film if you want it to look better than it did coming out of the camera.
Yeah. And that's something, but that's also something you can do. Once upon a time, color timing is you send film off to mm-hmm. Kodak and you sit there and you're like, I want it this tint and this exposure, or this whatever. And I feel like that's an easier process now that you can do it and kind of have more control over it yourself at home on your editing software.
Yes. And this was, it was edited at Premiere and was color graded in DaVinci. And again, Sebastian was like, I really want to do this. So, easier in the sense that you don't have to send it out and pay, but not necessarily like, actual process of doing it, which is, again, I know you know that. I'm just saying it for anyone listening. It's like, oh, I could do this. It's like, well, you're going to want to set aside a month or so at a time to make sure that every frame looks the way that you want it to look. But I was prepared to do this all here on, this MacBook that I'm talking to you on. But these people kind of rose their hands and were like, I would like to do this, because there was something about being like, oh, hey, we're doing a feature film, that they were like, I want to do a feature film, going back to my first thing, which is like, it's not that easy to, like, you could be an editor, you could go out to LA and very quickly end up being an editor assistant for a feature film. But if you're here, around Chicago, those opportunities don't come up a lot. So people are like, I want to do it. I want to do it with you guys. So very, all right. Very grateful.
Okay, movie shot, edited, color timed, color graded. Now you've got a movie on a disc or in the cloud, and you say, mm-hmm. I want people to see this movie. How do you get the movie seen by people?
Well, quick
easy
point,
to make a movie. Making a movie's easy.
We just did
an hour on all this. This is the easy part. You getting 8 people together in a room and $20,000. That's simple. Now you got to get people to see the movie. That's a million times harder. That's really much harder.
I would rather make a movie once a year than the step that we're about to talk to about here. Now, there is an easy way. We do live in this age of democratization of digital media. So I could put it on Vimeo. I could put it on YouTube. I am a millennial, so I wouldn't do this. But in theory, I could argue that I could cut it up into 90-second chunks and put it on TikTok. Like, I'm trying to get people to go watch Mean Girls or something. But I don't want to do that, right? Because, like... I mean, other people do, and I don't begrudge anyone. That's the big theme here. But I went through all this work, and my first gig that I got W-2 for was a movie theater. I love movie theaters. And so I want this thing to be seen in a movie theater. How do you do that? You can organize screenings. You could do like a four wall, which is... the practice of buying out a movie theater sets you about $1,000 back, but you could do that and then have like one time there. Or there's the festival route, which still exists. I wish I knew this before I started to submit to festivals. Two things. One, an observation/theory for me. Two, cold, hard, pragmatic, fact. The theory is I wanted to get this done so I could at least submit to the Chicago International Film Festival, which is in October every Chicago, because it's our hometown. In the fall, there are a lot of festivals that people know the names of. because those are usually when movies like September 5 this year or like Oscar contenders are being shown Telluride, things like that. Our film is not on the level of September 5 in scope or scale or anything like that. So the charitable thing is to say, like, we basically got shut out of those first four film festivals. We're starting to play in the spring, and I think that's because the spring is a time for smaller, spring, summer is a time for smaller film festivals. And our film, I wanted to punch above our weight, but it's still a 20 grand film in one location with two actors. Now, the cold, hard, pragmatic advice that I later got was by listening to people that programs festivals is like, they get a lot of submissions, and you might think like, oh, that sounds like work, but, or like just like something they're telling you to be nice, but it's not. They get a lot of submissions, and they are not programming a screening for you. They're programming a festival. So you don't know what they're looking for. They're looking, you know, you don't know what theme that they're starting to develop as they watch all these submissions, or like this film pairs well with this film, or what theme they might have decided on going into it. You don't know. So it's a numbers game. So you're going to spend anywhere from $20 to $100 submitting to festivals, and that should be part of your budget, which we did set aside some money that we came up with among the four of us, mostly probably at this point, is to do that. But it is a numbers game. And so I think I've submitted to like 12 to 15, and we've gotten two confirmations. We will be playing in my home state of Michigan and then in Georgia. And we have many submissions out there that we're waiting for. We also were able to be part of the screening series at the Music Box here in Chicago, which was aspirational when we started. We were like, what if we got to play at the Music Box? And so as part of the screening series about producing, so we screened the movie to about 60, 65 people, I believe, and got to talk about it afterwards. But the short answer after that long answer is like, you have to now, like, then you have to basically, you're a garage band trying to book venues, shows, festivals, everything like that. So that's what I'm doing this year in 2025. I'm submitting to festivals. I'm organizing screenings. I'll take this movie to around the country if I have to, if we have to do a road show, either via festivals or people that happen to see it and they're interested in showing it. And then after that, then we'll see, like, we'll start to, you know, we'll seek out some like smaller distributors and see if they're interested, in which case then they might have existing relationships with all sorts of streaming services. There are more than just the ones that we know. And then eventually, like, we'll, you know, put it somewhere where it could be seen. But we're essentially like on that like old tiered path of festivals, maybe a screening at a theater here in Chicago for three or four nights or whatever, and then see if we could get it onto a streaming platform, and then just having it be out there. But I did not want to do all this and sort of like treat it as if it was just an something made for the web, because like I said, my first gig was at a movie theater. I'm very passionate about theatrical screenings and the whole business. So I really wanted to do that. And then the funny thing is, so on the day that we were at the Music Box, we sold out essentially. I think there may be like maybe five tickets left. We essentially sold out their smaller theater, and we did a Q&A, and it was like the first public screening. Later that day, Scott Derrickson was there for his new movie, The Gorge, doing a Q&A, and they sold that out. So it was a very big day for me and Scott Derrickson at the Music Box selling it out. So if I ever cross paths with him, I'm going to be like, hey, the two of us sold out a movie. And then we're on Letterboxd. So a bunch of people wrote reviews, like, you know, for us, a good amount of people wrote reviews after the movie, and And then I got my letterbox rushes, and a couple friends of mine are friends with Drew Hancock, who that weekend released Companion, or Warner Brothers released Companion for him. He wrote and directed it. So my letterbox rushes were Companion and I Agree With You. And I was like, in the little posters, I was like, me and Drew Hancock doing a lot of work among our group of friends. And reality is, like, a lot of people that I follow happen to be at our screening too. So, but you know what? In this little micro budget world, you take your wins when you can. And you just kind of go, huh, that's funny. There's my movie next to all these other ones. I'll take it. And if anyone's, I don't know when this is going to air, but on February 28th, we will be the first screening of the Lake Michigan Film Festival outside Lansing, Michigan. And it is at a local regional Midwest theater chain that was the same theater chain where I got my first job in high school, day after I turned 16 at a movie theater. And more importantly, it is where my mom worked at when she was in high school and met my dad. So it's like theater chain that is directly responsible for me existing, and I'm able to show my film at it. And it's like a little, you know, between that and the music box, you're like, okay, like, I sincerely, you take the W's where you can in the micro independent film making world. And so that's really cool.
Yeah. Well, that's the whole process there. So if you're in Michigan, if you're in Michigan, you want to go to the Lake Michigan Film Festival. That's February 28th. I'm sure we have some listeners up there. So go check. Are you going to be there, Jake? Can they come say hi to you?
Yes, please do. I'll be there with the producers, and we'll talk about, we'll answer questions about the movie, not the process. So that will be kind of fun.
Yeah. That'll be fun. That'll be a good time. As you know, I always like to close by asking if there's anything I should have asked. I feel like we covered a lot here. It's a long episode. But if there's anything you think folks should know that we did not discuss, what would be the one tip you would give people to think about if they have any interest in making a feature film?
Please do it. I mean, I know I don't want to sugarcoat it. Hopefully after this conversation, you're like, wow, it's a lot of work. But regardless of how old you are, like, if you're a 65-year-old, recently retired CPA that has had this burning desire to make a movie, I want to see it. I want you to spend your retirement putting together your film and look me up for advice or anything I do, or just send me a link, because I want to see that. There is this age of democratization of filmmaking, and the Coppola Hearts of Darkness movie, he said that one day this is going to happen, and it's going to blow the doors off the studios, and some little girl in Ohio is going to make something beautiful. And like, yeah, she can, and so can you. And, you know, so do it. That's my advice. It's never been easier. It's still difficult, but it is, if you have that desire, it is 150% worth it. So please make your movie. That's my pitch. Make your movie and make sure that I can and watch it when it's ready.
Excellent. Jake, thanks for being on the show. Good luck. We'll be rooting for the success of I Agree With You, which, again, we're going to be honest here. It's probably not going to get a 3,000 screen release. It's probably not going to be playing on IMAX near you. But once it hits the VOD and streaming channels, I hope everybody gives it a chance and checks it out. It is a you know, nice little bulwark community film night maybe we can do.
Oh, yeah, could be 100%. But if you are from A24 listening, get my info from Sonny. I'll talk to you.
If you want to give Jake $1 million, I think he'll happily accept that as a nice little distribution fund put this in 3,000 screens. I think it could play. I think that would be good. But no, it's a fun little movie. I don't want to discuss the art here. We can do that on a later episode, maybe.
Oh yeah.
But the But no, it's a nice little, you know, kind of, again, 75-minute relationship drama. It's good. Jake, thank you for being on the show today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Sonny. This was awesome. Really appreciate it.
And as you mentioned, I am Sonny Bunch. I am culture editor at The Bulwark, and I will be back next week with another episode of The Bulwark Goes to Hollywood. We'll see you guys then.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
Lowe's knows that no matter your paint project, saving is at the top of your list. That's why when you shop today, you can buy one, get one free, select Valspar and HGTV Home by Sherwin-Williams, one coat coverage interior paints via rebate. Shop these deals in-store or online today at Lowe's. We help, you save. Selection varies by location. While supplies last. Discount taken at time of purchase. See sales associate for details. Offer valid 8/21 through 9/3.